everyone. My name is Ron Way. You're about to hear one of a series of radio broadcasts that aired over the radio show called An Eye on Faith. The original shows aired in 1992 and 93, but because they're interviews with Christian scholars, archaeologists, religious leaders, and authors from many faiths and from around the world, their messages are timeless, and as timely as when they were first aired. Of course, when you hear the phone numbers, they're no longer in service, so please don't call. We would love to hear from you, however, so email me at rway, that's R-W-A-Y, at thediscipleSite.com, or leave your comments on my blog, thediscipleblog.wordpress.com, and I'll get back to you. So now, sit back and enjoy the ride back in time to the founding of Christianity, Judaism, Buddhism, Tao, meditation, and the like. Enjoy. Welcome, everyone. This is Ron Way with another edition of An Eye on Faith. Today, we are privileged to meet a very, very unusual author who is going to take us into the Chinese world of Tao. His name is Deng Ming Tao, and the name of the book is Chronicles of Tao. Welcome, Deng, to An Eye on Faith.
Thank you.
It's indeed a pleasure. I got to tell you, Deng, when I first picked up your book a couple of weeks ago, it was the first time, absolutely the first time, I'd read anything about Taoism. And when I had finished, I found your book to be one of the most fascinating books that I had ever read. And my listeners will tell you, I don't say this very often. In fact, I'll make you blush because I'm going to list your book in one of the top 10 spiritual books that I've ever come across.
That does make me blush quite a bit, but thank you very much.
Well, I got to tell you, my wife and I fought over it. We were at a talk show conference a week ago in Chicago. And my wife and I have been fighting over the book. When she put it down, I'd grab it, and that was the rule of the game. Whoever got it first got to read until you set it down. So we've had an amazing time. But I'll tell you, nowhere have I found a book that took me back behind the bamboo curtain into this ancient world that still exists, doesn't it?
That's right. Even though communism has wiped out quite a bit of it, there are still individual practitioners in Indonesia and Southeast Asia, the United States, and probably still some in China. So this is still very much a viable way of life.
Well, I have a million questions, Deng, and we'll get to them as we go through this hour, and because it's going to be a fascinating hour, ladies and gentlemen. But first, I want to mention to our listeners that what makes this book interesting is that it isn't a book about the Taoist religion. It's about a living master of Tao, still alive today in the United States, isn't he?
That's correct.
But a master who has lived and experienced all of the mystical feats that we only hear about in the East. This man has seen them, done them, and is here in the United States and sharing that with a very few number of very special students. And Deng, he is your teacher, am I right?
That's right. I've been studying with him for some 13 years now.
I think I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you the very first thing to set the stage. What is the religion or the practice of Tao? I know it means the way, which is interesting because Christianity was known as their early followers were the followers of the way. But tell us, first of all, what is Taoism and how did you come across it?
Okay, well, that's a two-part question. But
okay, we'll start on part one.
First, to talk about Taoism as a spiritual practice is complicated. It's like asking someone to say what's Christianity in a few sentences. But Taoism is the only indigenous spiritual tradition in China. Buddhism is imported, Islam is imported, and Christianity, of course, is imported as well. It started out from shamanistic roots, from nature worship and so on, and gradually evolved over the course of Chinese history. And you know, Chinese history is so complicated. For Taoism to absorb all those different elements, it too became very complicated. So eventually it encompassed everything from ascetic practices, martial arts, breathing exercises, to liturgy, ritual, statecraft, military strategy, sorcery, and all sorts of things in between. So it's an extremely complicated system. But at its base, the idea is there is a flow to the universe. And there is a way that the universe progresses. if we as people can integrate ourselves with that way, then that is the method to live our lives the most successfully. When we are out of touch with that way, when we are out of balance, out of harmony, then that's when we have suffering. So very quickly, that's what Taoism is all about, and that's its relevance to today. As for how I met my teacher, I met him in the time-honored way. I met him by accident. I ran into him in a park because two friends of mine were looking for a Tai Chi teacher, and in the course of talking to him, I got so excited and so interested in the system he had to present that I was the one who eventually became the student and stayed.
Well, I find it interesting. I read in your book where the incidents of meeting him. Now, you've got to back up a little just for a second. We will go into this man's life because it was a fascinating story of how this man lived and in a world really that we don't know anymore, a world before World War II, yet this man is still alive. And in fact, when you saw him, he was appeared in a bush, didn't he, watching you and your friends?
That's right.
In San Francisco, I think.
In San Francisco, my friend and I were practicing a Tai Chi exercise called pushing hands. And this guy appeared in the bushes, and he looked really big. He looked like a biker or a college jock. He had very large shoulders, almost no gray in his hair. I really couldn't see it at a glance, no wrinkles on his face. And he just stood there looking at us, and it was really annoying because he had this sort of pugnacious air about him. So I wasn't prepared to meet anyone like that at all.
And how old was he when you did meet him?
I guess he was in his mid-60s when I met him.
And he looked like a young biker.
He looked like 20s.
Oh, my gosh. Well, that's a fascinating story. I think if you will allow me, I would like to start working a little bit through this man's life. Because Could you tell us about how he was born? I know he was born very, very wealthy family.
Yes.
A little bit how he began his own spiritual path through Taoism. And why don't you set the scene for us?
Well, my teacher, whose name is Guan Saihong, was born in 1920 to an aristocratic Chinese family. And as many of your listeners probably know, at that point, the empire had just collapsed, and there was still a very vital aristocracy. My teacher's father was a general. His mother was an art and music teacher. But my teacher was a very naughty boy and very hard to control. And he was so difficult to control that his grandfather took over raising him. At one festival, my teacher ran into his future Taoist master by accident again. And seeing that there was some rapport between the master and Guan, his grandfather petitioned the master to take him on as a student. So at the age of 9, my teacher was sent to Huashan, which is one of the 5 sacred mountains of China, and there he lived in the monastery along with hundreds of other boys and men, and that's when his training in Taoism really began.
Now, so, when you said that he was born during the time of the Last Emperor, is that like the movie, The Last Emperor, that was the same one?
Well, yes, the empire fell in 1911. So by the time my teacher was born, it had been a very short time since the empire was gone.
And there still were feudal lords throughout China.
Oh, there were warlords up until the revolution, up until 1949. And in fact, Guan's father was one of those generals fighting in the warlord armies. So the fact that the empire fell did not mean a simple and easy transition into a republican government. It meant that the whole country fell into this civil war, warlord fighting against warlord, the Japanese coming in, eventually the Allies participating as well. So it was a very difficult time.
And it's a fascinating story that we're about to undertake in just a second. We're going to have to take our first break. It goes so fast, doesn't it?
Yes.
Ladies and gentlemen, I know that you're going to love to hear this story because it's a story of amazing deeds, of magic, we would call it. I guess we've heard of the Indian fakirs of doing some of these things, but I'd never heard of the Chinese performing some of these feats. And this is his master who lives in San Francisco, has seen it, he's been there, he's done it, and we'll be right back. back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Ron Wei. We're with Deng Ming Dao. We're talking about a fantastic new book that's just come out, published by Harper San Francisco, isn't it?
That's correct.
Right, who publish many, many fascinating religious books. And we're talking about Taoism. And when we left last, Deng, we were talking about your master, who was born in 1920. At the age of what? What was the age again? He left his home?
Oh, he left his home at the age of 9 and went to the monastery.
And now I would like for you to tell us a little bit about the training of these young boys, because he was one of the youngest there, if I'm not mistaken. And tell us about some of what happens to this young boy as he grows up, and what does he experience? Because this is fascinating. These are events that we just hear about in mystical books, but he lived it.
Oh, he not only lived it, but these things were very ordinary to him living in the temple. First of all, to briefly set the scene, this mountaintop where he lived is about 7,000 feet high. Very cold, very hard to get to. There's only one trail up, and you have to do pretty much a day's worth of mountain climbing to reach the summit. And on this mountainside were all sorts of very special men, and I say men because that's all there was up there. It was a monastery. And they specialized in extraordinary things, certain ascetic practices, certain forms of meditation that imitated animals like frogs or bats, martial arts, and very intense scrutiny of the scriptures. So as a boy, he was gradually led into this life. From 9 to 12, he had two tutors who were young men in their teens. And then gradually, as he grew older, he would attend more formal classes. But what they did was they prepared him for every stage of life that he would go through. They didn't hold anything back from him. They taught him unreservedly about health, hygiene, sex, the kinds of things that he would go through when he left the mountain, and so on.
And that's kind of interesting, because when they put him in the monastery, they didn't mean for him to become a monk originally, his family. They meant for him to just be trained and educated by these monks, then come back and fulfill a family role, right?
That's correct. In that day, the monasteries fulfilled a role much like the universities of today. The vast majority of students did not stay to become priests. They only went there to get a very good classical education, to acquire discipline, to acquire unusual arts, and then come out into the world. It was only at the age of 12 that my teacher was so influenced by the monastic life that he gradually began to make that transition towards becoming a priest.
Why don't you give an overview of his life first? Because I think that would set the stage. Because he went through many phases. It came a time when he was, 15, 16 years old, when it was time to make a decision. He got caught up in the Japanese war with Japan, I believe. And then he went back in. Why don't you give us a thumbnail of an overview? And then we'll delve into some of the practices.
I guess the overriding theme to my teacher's life is that he has always alternated between a worldly life and a monastic life. And each time he was in the monastery, I think he would chafe at the discipline and the rigors that were imposed upon him. Each time he went to the outside world, he would become disillusioned by the manipulations and the evils that he saw there. So back in fourth, he would go between the monastery and the world. At the age of 16, the Sino-Japanese War really came to full power, and so he had his first crisis of conscience. He was trained as a martial artist. His father was a general, and it wasn't a matter of a distant war. From the mountainside, they could see the bombs falling and the planes flying overhead, and he went against his master's wishes and went to war. When he came back 2 years later, his master did welcome him back, and he trained again for a time. The next big time that he had to go away is when one of his classmates had to be brought back because of the crimes his classmate had committed. And the result of that hunt disillusioned my teacher again, and again he left the monastery. He went back after having been a Peking opera performer, after having been an undersecretary to Zhou Enlai, after having wandered all through China and Europe and so on. And then the final time he left the mountain was because his master sent him away. And his master told him that he had some unfulfilled destiny and he had to leave the mountain. And with no further explanation, my master was basically expelled. And that was the time that he came to the United States. So since that time, he's been trying to continue his practices as a Taoist, even though he's far away from his master and the temples have been closed. So I would say, in thumbnail, that's the broad theme of my master's life, this alternation between the monastery and the world.
Now, is his master still alive? Does he know that? I noticed in the book you mentioned that he charges a nominal fee, a minimal fee for training you just to keep alive, and part of it went back to his master, but I'm not sure what period time frame that was.
Well, when I wrote about that particular incident, that was, of course, 13 years ago, but as far as I've been told, the master is indeed still alive. He and two acolytes live alone on an island somewhere in northern China, and they have been put there to keep them from having contact with the outside world, and I suppose in a way to protect them as well.
Who put them there?
Zhou Enlai put them there at the during the Cultural Revolution.
Oh my gosh, during the Cultural Revolution. So, then did your teacher play a role in protecting him at that time?
No, not at that point. My teacher was here in the United States at the time that his master was isolated, if you will. But we do know that Zhou Enlai knew something about Taoists. We know that he did treasure many cultural things and surreptitiously tried to protect them. And so, of course, I can't find any official corroboration for this, but we can only suspect that he knew of my grandmaster and put him on the island partially to protect him and partially to prevent Taoism from being perpetuated during that time.
And how old is the grandmaster now?
Well, I can't say, you know, for sure, because there are no records or anything like that, but I'm sure he's well over 140 is what I've been told.
That's amazing. And I guess you believe that because your teacher is now in his 70s and looks how old?
Oh, he looks maybe 40, and he can still do acrobatics. He can still do jumping. He can handle heavy weapons that none of us can do. He can still knock the biggest guy down in class.
Including you, I suppose.
Well, I'm not the biggest guy. There are guys in class who outweigh me by a good 50 pounds, people who are college wrestlers, one guy who's a policeman, and he'll go at it with anybody.
And we're going to find out more about the martial arts because that played a big part in his training right after this break. Hang on, everyone. Welcome back, everyone. This is Ron Wei with An Eye on Faith, and we're with Deng Mingdao, and he has written a book, an incredible book, called The Chronicles of Tao. Now, we're talking about your master. Say his name again, because Chinese, and I can read it, but it doesn't sound like what you said.
All right. His name is Guan Sai Hong.
Guan Sai Hong.
All right. That's pretty close.
When we left, we were talking about martial arts. Now, in your book, martial arts, and that means hand-to-hand combat, I believe, and with weapons, but hand weapons, plays a major part in their training. Their physical training, their mental training, all comes to play. And you tell some incredible tales of battle that he has waged, and his master before him. And I want you to tell a story about, and we haven't talked about this before, but do you remember in your book where you told about there was, your master had played a trick on his master? And he wrote a letter and basically challenged, called three bullies idiots, and then he challenged them to arrive during a high holy day, and his master didn't know anything about it, and he forged his name to it. Why don't you tell that story? It's fascinating.
That's right. Just to give your viewers a quick background, martial arts in China was somewhat like gunslinging in the Old West, was somewhat like the Knights of the Round Table, in that personal combat was a means of self-cultivation and was really a way of life. So my master's teacher, my grandmaster, even though he was the abbot of the temple, had a past life, before he entered the temple, had a life as a swordsman. My teacher, as I mentioned before, was a very naughty boy, and being in the monastery didn't change that. One time in his wanderings, he saw three men who called themselves Heaven, Earth, and Man, and that would be somewhat tantamount to someone in the West calling themselves the Holy Trinity. And they advertised this title to show their prowess as fighters. My teacher went in to challenge them, saw he couldn't beat them, and so in revenge went back and wrote a fake letter of challenge to these three men and signed it with his master's name. So on the highest holy day, this is the day to the Taoist Trinity, the three men broke into the temples, and my master told me, I didn't put this in the book, that Guan paid the different sentry monks to let these three all the way through the gates.
He
so
is
that
worse
they could
than
go
I
right
heard.
Up to the temple.
Oh my gosh, no wonder his master was mad.
So they broke the door down, and in spite of the Grand Master's protests, they attacked him, and that, of course, is when my grandmaster had to rely on his martial prowess. And
now, tell us, I don't want to interrupt, but tell us how old he is roughly at this time.
Well, he already had white hair, and my God, he must have been maybe late 90s, something like that.
Uh-huh. And now here's three young brutes broke into the temple.
That's right. And my grandmaster, you see, is a very old-fashioned gentleman, very classical, and people have probably seen pictures of Chinese gentlemen who have very long sleeves, and my grandmaster's specialty is to fight with his sleeves, because that, of course, disdains his opponents even more, and he is able to whip his sleeves around so quickly that it's like hitting someone with a whip. Also, he's cultivated a lot of internal power, and so he's able to still fight as a young man might. So that's how he beat them. He beat all three of them. He had them healed. And then, of course, he caught my teacher and had him punished severely.
And what did he do? He locked him away where?
He locked him away in a cave. And in this cave was a stalagmite. And in the stalagmite, it was only a few feet across. My teacher had to sit and meditate for 49 days with only gruel and water. So that was his punishment to try to
contemplate.
And
they surrounded, if I remember, it was kind of like a little island. There was water around it. They
That's
put a
right.
plank over so he couldn't get off of it.
That's right, and couldn't commit any other mischief for at least those 49 days.
And then he started all over again,
then
didn't he?
Then he started all over.
He must be quite a man.
He hasn't even stopped now.
Well, you know, speaking of caves, you have to tell the people, in one of his tests to become a priest, or after he was a priest, but if growth, part of it was to be locked away in a cave for how long?
Well, it originally started as 9 months, and the culmination of the Taoist practice is intense meditation. They say that meditation is central. It's the key to everything. Scriptures, martial arts, ritual, all that is secondary to self-realization. So his final practice was to go into a cave to read sutras, to recite, to spend much time in intense meditation. The normal course was 9 months. Of course, my teacher lost all track of time, and perhaps because he was such a recalcitrant subject, the time stretched on to 2 years until his master finally released him.
And he had been sealed in there all that time. Now, I know that people in the West would not believe some of the things that transpired in that cave. But why don't you just tell us real quickly about one or two events, or maybe one event here, it happened in that cave. To show them what happens to the mind when you are going through these purities and learning to control your mind and master your mind and your body.
My teacher, as he meditated in the cave, was confronted with a variety of temptations. And in one of these cases, a woman appeared to him and urged him to give up his ascetic practices and said, "You know, what good is it to practice? You only end up being poverty-stricken, covered in ash, a poor mendicant wandering the countryside. It's far better to be with me. It's far better to have love and wealth and honor and so on." And she would tempt him in this way. And
tempting is really true, because here was an ascetic monk. He's a virgin.
That's right. He still is to this day. He's been celibate his whole life.
And this is to bring, to use all his energy, his sexual energy, and turn it upwards to become spiritual energy.
Right. And so, of course, the opposite of that is to be tempted to go into lust and sex and so on. And this temptation lasted the whole night, and in spite of all his efforts, he was not really able to stop her from being there and so on. And when she saw that she could not penetrate his determination, she turned into a monster, and then this monster attacked him for the rest of the night, and the only thing that saved him was the coming of daylight. Now, there are many other incidents like this recounted in the book, and many people think of this as a very fantastic thing. And I said to him as I was interviewing him, I said, did this stuff really happen?
Uh-huh.
He said to me, you know, if you had been locked in a cave for 2 years, you would see things too.
That's right.
But he said he didn't doubt that the spirits that came to tempt him could have harmed him in some way.
And we're going to have to take a quick break, but we're going to be right back and hear about some more of these fantastic things. Hang on. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Ron Way, and you're listening to An Eye on Faith, and we're here with Deng Ming Dao, author of an incredible new book called Chronicles of Dao. And we were talking about your master, Deng, and he had been locked 2 years in a cave. Now, what happens to some of these people? Do they ever go mad when they're locked in like this?
Some of the people do go mad. They are unable to resist the temptations, and they fall into state of mental instability. Some of them, you might say, act like what we would call today as schizophrenics and so on. And there was no treatment for it. These people were locked into little huts all over the mountainside and just fed. And the Taoists couldn't heal them, couldn't fix them or anything. So that last stage of meditation, that last stage of having to confront oneself and one's temptations was not a simple matter, was not a matter of just sitting there in a cave. It had some real risks to it.
Well, as I told you during the break, as I read some of the things that happened to this man, real or imagined, I would have been terrified. I mean, to live in this cave, he describes how this goes back miles into the mountain, and there's, oh gee, remember that stairway you described that went down 1,500 stairs, I think, and he started hearing people down in this blackness, and that was so far down, there was no light. He was pitch black.
That's right. This cave was essentially a labyrinth, and there were all sorts of very odd and strange things throughout the cave, and in between his meditations, he would go searching. One time, he came out to this opening, and he saw a forest that was not like any forest seen anywhere around there. At another time, he saw an unusual animal prancing around, looking at him, urging him to come and play. All these things were not things that were normal sights around that mountainside, and his master would only say that they had some meaning to him.
Uh-huh.
It was something he had to decipher. And so what happened in this labyrinth, and what were the limits of his mind? Those were the things he tested during those 2 years.
How long has Taoism been practiced? Is this a very ancient religion?
It is very ancient. If you go by what the Taoists say, they say that Taoism started about 5,000 B.C. If you go by what the West says, they usually trace Taoism to Lao Tzu, who was about 500 B.C. But most scholars who read Lao Tzu admit that the concepts he's put forth were clearly concepts that predated him.
Mm-hmm.
So somewhere between 5,000 and 500 B.C., we definitely know that Taoism had its origin.
Now, it did have some intermixing during the history with Hinduism, did it not, and perhaps Buddhism?
That's correct. Taoism is not what you would call a religion that only wants to keep itself pure in that sense.
And they don't follow any one spiritual teacher like Christianity or Islam.
No. What they will do is they will follow a particular master, and the master will force them to survey the whole of Taoism. That would be like saying you had to study every saint in Catholicism before you could even start to determine what you believed in. But then each master would hold to some particular theme. It might just be one line out of the Tao Te Ching. It might be martial arts. It might be a certain vision he had had, or some strange thing like that. But his students would all have to to survey the whole of Taoism before they came to specialize.
Mm-hmm. And then choose a master, perhaps, or does a master choose him in a specialty?
Usually, it's a two-way thing. Mm-hmm. The student might petition a master, but if the master feels no connection, he won't accept that student.
Right.
But Taoism did absorb influences from many other religions because, at least as my master has explained to me, every religion has something valid to put forth. And so if Taoism saw any technique or belief that it felt was superior to what it had already, they borrowed it.
Hmm.
They took, for example, Kundalini meditation from Hindu systems. They took certain yoga postures from Hindu systems. They took certain breathing exercises from the Tibetans. They took certain martial arts and special kinds of qigong from the Buddhist systems, and so on. So they're very eclectic, and as long as they feel it can fit into their concept of the way, they think it's all valid.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting. You mentioned, and again, I go back to martial arts because much of his training was in martial arts. Besides, half of his training probably martial arts, the other half in preparing his body and spiritually. But some of, I mean, students of martial arts like yourself, I would find, listening to this would be interesting to find that some of the training was absolutely more rigorous probably than anybody seen here in the United States. Tell them about how they had to balance on the poles when they fought.
Oh, these...
The challenge?
Yes.
And also the teacups.
Well, this is called the plum flower pattern. And it's not enough to say, I can stand up and punch somebody. It's not enough to say that I can move nimbly around. How good is your balance? So in one of the methods, they put 108 teacups down, upside down, on the floor in a plum flower pattern. And there you have to spar with somebody, but you can only step from teacup to teacup. And that trains your stance. That shows how precise your movements are. And, of course, the first person to step off the teacup loses. So that's an example of the high forms of martial arts. Another time, this is not in my book, but my teacher saw two men fighting. One was a Wing Chun master, the other was a monkey master. They fought only on a four-square table. So as you can imagine, fighting on a tabletop, you have no room to move, and yet they were able to kick, hit, and dodge all at the same time. So martial arts is very rigorous in China, but it develops a very tough personality.
Well, it really gets tough because I can remember one incident in your book. I think they fought in poles like 10 feet tall, and there was spears or swords down below.
Yes, this is a variation of the teacup pattern, and actually the teacup pattern is developed from those poles. Those are called the plum flower piles, and they were developed by a Buddhist nun in the 1700s, that's correct. And actually, some of you have probably heard of Wing Chun, which was Bruce Lee's original style. And Wing Chun was developed by this nun who also developed the plum flower piles. And what you had to do, each pole was a step apart. So therefore, your footwork had to be absolutely precise. And if you fell, you fell onto these upturned knives. So the risk was very great. But obviously, only masters fought on plum flower piles.
Obviously, or, well, we didn't hear about them after that anyway.
You didn't hear about the rest.
No more. We're going to take our last break here, ladies and gentlemen. I don't know about you, but I find this absolutely fascinating. And I want to thank you, Deng, for being with us today and sharing your knowledge. We'll be right back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Ron Wei with Deng Ming Dao. And we're talking about his brand new book called Chronicles of Dao, published by Harper San Francisco. Welcome back, Deng.
Thanks.
We're just before the break, we're talking about martial arts. And I think the thought that comes to perhaps all of us is, what does martial arts have to do with the spiritual growth and a religion of Taoism?
Well, first of all, you have to understand that Taoism posits internal energy, that is to say a physical energy, as a component to meditation. So unless one has physical vitality, the Taoists do not feel that they can be successful in meditation. Therefore, martial arts, being an excellent way to cultivate the physical and to create great health and strength and vitality is an ideal beginning to meditation. Obviously, the methods of killing and so on aren't part of spirituality, but they were part of that time. This is a time, as we've already said, that China was constantly at war, monasteries were always under attack, and so one had to use martial arts. But the core of martial arts, that is to say self-discipline and physical strength, can easily be exploited and used for meditation and spirituality.
Well, it is a training of the physical, and just like in Hinduism, there is the Hatha Yoga, which is the physical yoga, which is all part of the Raja Yoga, which is training the body to complement the mind, because you have to train the mind also.
That's right. The philosophy is the same, and the only difference between Taoism and Hinduism is that the Taoists believe in moving postures, whereas the Hindus tend to use the static postures of Hatha Yoga.
Right. Now, what about, let's bring us right up to the present. And ladies and gentlemen, you are going to have to get this book, because it is a book that you won't put down from the beginning to end. It is a book of one tale after another that sounds almost like fairy tales, but they're true, aren't they?
That's correct.
And tell us about now. What happens now? What does your master do? How are you participating with him, or does he take students? Tell us about your master.
My master isn't taking students anymore. He wants to retire and pursue his own penances, really, for everything that he's done. But he still trains us twice a week, and our training ranges everywhere from very physical things, like carrying people around on your shoulders, acrobatics, rolling, jumping, and so on, to training in fist forms, to weaponry, everything from how to fight with a fan to how to fight with a huge halberd. And then there's a lot of questions about meditation and philosophy. And my teacher says that the only thing that matters in this life is discipline. And if you have discipline, then you have the freedom. And if you have freedom, then you can follow the Tao.
Can I ask you a question? They talk about incredible feats of leaping and acrobatics in this. Have you ever seen your master perform any of these?
I've seen him do a lot of rolling and acrobatics. I haven't seen him do any high jumping. I've seen other people do it. My teacher has had a lot of injuries, and he did suffer some very serious accidents during the war, so that compromised some of his abilities.
Mm-hmm.
But some of the other things he can do still convince me that he was able to do those things in the past.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, this hour has flown by so fast, Deng, and I want to thank you so very much for being our guest here on I Am Faith and exposing us to the world of Tao, which many of us have never heard the word before you're able to come on our show. So I want to thank you very, very much.
Well, it's my pleasure to be here. Thank you.
And I wish you all the luck in the world, ladies and gentlemen. The book's name is Chronicles of Tao, and that's spelled T-A-O, right?
That's correct.
But pronounced Tao. Now, your last name is Ming Tao. Is that a throw to, does that mean anything to have anything to do with Tao?
Actually, it's my given name, and my grandfather gave me that name, and it means it's the same Tao as the Tao we've been talking about, and it means the clear way or the bright way.
Well, you certainly have exposed us a bright new way through your book, and I want to congratulate you on this, and I wish you all the success in the world to you and your publisher, Harper San Francisco.
Thank you.
Thank you very, very much.
You have it, folks. Another hour has just flown by. I hope you've enjoyed today's exploration into the world of Taoism and the amazing country of China as it has struggled to find its way out of the world of the emperor and their dynasties that go back 6,000 years into the distant past. And now it faces a modern world with no place for its own indigenous religion called Tao. That's it for today, folks. I hope you enjoyed looking back in time into an era and a place long gone. China is no longer the same China from which Taoism came. I hope you stay with us next week, same time, same station, when we talk to John Shelby Spong. He's Bishop of the Episcopal Church. And speaking of Easter coming up very, very soon, he's going to be talking to us about resurrection, myth or reality. I don't think you want to miss this. He's an interesting man. I think you'll enjoy listening to him. He's a wonderful speaker, and I think he'll tell you an amazing story. He has his own faith, and a faith that is often challenging the church. And I think you'd be fascinated to hear him. And I found his book fascinating too. So I'll see you next week. Same time, same station.
Until then, God bless.